Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Stone, this is going to be a good one.
Good morning, sir. It certainly is. We've got a studio full. We even have a little bit of paparazzi slash entourage joining us this morning. We have our fearless producer, Ryan Redhawk McPherson, fresh off his last Veterans Connect radio show. This is going to be fun. All right. First up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, we have with us co-founder with Diva Foodies, and she's also with Diva Marketing. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast, Miss Toby Bloomberg. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Stone. Good to be here. Even though it's a rainy, icky day in Atlanta, it is warm and exciting here.
So, Toby, you've been around the blogging, social media world for a little bit. Can you share a little bit about your background?
Sure. I started in blogging back in 2004, so I have been around the block for a while.
You're an original gangster.
I like that. I'm putting that on my bio, original gangster. Thanks, Lee. And actually, I started my blog, Diva Marketing Blog, because somebody told me I could not blog unless, or talk about blogs unless I actually had one. So back in 2004, there were not a whole lot of people doing business blogs. We had websites, but not blogs. And I said, I can do anything I want. I don't need a blog. And they said, oh, no, yes, you do. And I did. And they were absolutely right. And within actually days after I launched my blog, I had people coming onto me digitally saying, welcome to the blogosphere. So as I mentioned, I had a website, but nobody welcomed me when I launched my website. But people were welcoming me into the blogosphere. So all of a sudden, I realized it was a way far different world.
And then when did the Diva brand begin?
The Diva Foodie brand began about 2 years ago. We saw that there was a need in the culinary world to help chefs, cookbook authors, restaurants, foodpreneurs, a lot of foodpreneurs that are trying to get out and build their business. We saw there was a need for them to understand digital and social media a little better.
So now how do you work with them?
The way most consultants work with them, we help them build out their digital and social media profiles. We provide coaching, and we also will do a little bit of their execution work, but we really want the voice and the tonality to come from the owner or the brand or the chef. So,
I bet that's strong to have the chef's personality come to life in these efforts.
It is. And what's really a challenge, Stone, is the branding, the personal branding of a chef. So a chef has his or her own brand that they're building their business or building their culinary expertise, but then they're also affiliated more than not with a company. And sometimes it's their own and sometimes it's a restaurant. And so our challenge is how do you merge the two so that the personality of the chef and the company, first of all, doesn't get lost. So they're two separate ingredients, so to speak. But at the same time, they create one overarching, call it digital vision.
Now, how does the blog play into the, it seems like everywhere you turn, there's food on television now.
Yeah, everywhere. From PBS to Bravo to Food Network.
To the big networks too. They have baking competitions and food competitions on ABC, CBS, NBC.
Yes. And in addition to that, what's really taking off, Leah, are the kids.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seems like now everything that was for the adult chef is now for the child.
Yeah, and the kids are quite exciting. So we are building relationships with food TV chefs, and one of our strongest relationships is with a young man who's now 14. His name is Logan Gialf, and Logan won MasterChef Junior a few years ago, and he is the youngest, I believe, chef, can I put that in air quotes, to have participated in a James Beard competition.
Wow.
Very talented young man. Gordon Ramsay has called him the next up-and-coming great chef. Gordon Ramsay knows his business, so watch out for Logan.
Well, and some of that yelling's play acting for Gordon, isn't it?
I would think so. I would think a little bit.
That's the belief I choose to hold. So how does the whole sales and marketing thing work for you? As a consultant, does your phone ring off the hook? Or are you out somehow with a strategy to meet and build relationships with these chefs and these brands and these restaurant investors?
Our phone doesn't ring off the hook, but sometimes our digital Twitter does.
Uh-huh.
And that's a great deal of our strategy is to be up in those networks, to be active in the networks. And a lot of our clients have come through relationships that we've built on Twitter. In fact, probably, I would say, the most significant number of chefs that we have relationships with, especially on the food TV aspect of it, have all come from Twitter. So we have over 40 chefs that we've built relationships with over the past couple of years. We do a tweet chat, and all that has happened on Twitter. So you can make real relationships and real friendships in the digital world.
Now, can you share a little bit about that hashtag food TV chat? What is that and the schedule and things like that?
Sure. Thanks. I appreciate that, Lee. So the food TV chat, hashtag food TV chat, brings food TV contestants like from all types of social media into one place, and that's on Twitter. And so a tweet chat is a way that we can have a conversation at a specific time on a specific topic. Most tweet chats are a vertical. Somebody asks a question, and then the whole community responds.
Mm-hmm.
Our tweet chat's a little different. We call it it's very hectic, very chaotic. We interview these chefs on Twitter. And because, obviously, we can't corral the Twitter community and say, don't tweet.
Stop tweeting for half an hour.
Exactly. It turns out to be an interview within an interview within an interview within an interview.
Because then they start asking questions.
Exactly.
Too. Then does the chef then choose whatever they want to answer? Is it like kind of one of the, what is it, the AMA, the Reddit, when they do those?
Sort of. And yes, the chef can choose which questions to answer. And the stream, you know, moves so quickly.
Right.
That we try to retweet the questions that we think might be most interesting for the entire community.
And then, so how long does one of those chats last?
An hour. We started with 30 minutes, and then the chef said it's not enough time, so we pushed it to an hour.
What a fun idea. And so do you put a lot of thought and energy into the questions that you're going to ask from your, what is it, a handle, Twitter handle?
Yes.
And so, but then you don't know what's going to come in. You don't know what Ryan might ask him, right, if he taps in?
Exactly, yeah. We always have conversations with the chefs before we do it. And our goals are two-fold. First of all, it's to help the chefs create community for themselves, to get their brand out, to get their messaging out. But it's also to bring the people that are passionate about food TV and food and these chefs and these shows together so they have a real opportunity to actually engage with the chefs that they've been following week after week after week. And it's fun. And again, it's very chaotic. Interview within an interview within an interview.
And then during the course of this hour, how many questions will they typically answer?
We create probably about 20, which is a bit of an overkill,
right?
Because all these other questions are coming in. And then what we also do to answer questions anywhere, probably about 30. We like to try to have conversations. So because we are connected to so many chefs, if there's something that we see that might pull in another chef, mm-hmm. we will at handle them. And they'll see us in their stream, and then they'll join the conversation. So we may start with one chef, but at the end of the tweet chat, we may be talking to three or four.
All right. So all of this, though, at some point needs to culminate in a return on investment for the chef's time and whatever your fee structure and that kind of thing is. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you measure success, how you tie it to those kinds of results?
Well, first of all, there is no fee associated with our tweet chat.
Well, so, ROI ought to be fairly easy then, huh?
Right.
Even I can do that, man.
Right. So, and that the reason for that is twofold. First of all, the chefs have to get permission from their handlers at the network or at the franchises. And if there were a fee associated it, they probably wouldn't be able to come on. So going back to your question, the ROI for us and for them is the Twitter awareness. We can track that through hashtags. The extent of reach, and of course, the engagement.
All right. No, that makes that'd be like if we charged people to be guests on our show. That's, I guess, a business model. Well, we wouldn't have this caliber of guests, right? You'd have the more aspirational person that's just trying to.
Right.
All right. Okay. So help me think this through then. But yeah. But there is a business model somewhere in there for your organization.
Yes.
So there's other services that you're. Okay.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So we don't charge for the tweet chat. So what it does for Diva Foodies is it helps get us out into the food community. Mm. It helps us build relationships with these chefs. And it helps us create credibility. One of the projects that we're currently working on, again, going back to the monetization, we realized that we really couldn't monetize the show, but we might be able to monetize the relationships with the chef. Now, that sounds a little bit self-serving, and it's not really, because it's a win-win-win situation. Win for us, win for the chef, and win for the guest or the audience. And so right now what we're doing is we are talking to, and I have a meeting after I leave here, to the Atlanta Art Institute, to their culinary division. What we want to do is we want to put together a pop-up event. I'm sure you're all familiar with pop-up
sure.
restaurants. We want to blow this out, blow it out, and make it a real event. So the chefs who are doing the cooking are all TV food chefs. And the caveat is, the real special aspect is, that you can watch the chefs cook the food that you will be eating and
wow.
ask them questions, engage with them at the same time. And then, of course, there'll be engagement throughout, lots of photo ops, and we're looking for sponsors, by the way. So here's a little plug.
So now, you kind of are marrying the social media world with the real life world and the television. You're combining all kind of these channels in a unique manner. Has that been kind of the way you've been attacking social media through the years?
Yeah, that's very, very intuitive of you, Lee, because a lot of people don't understand it. We totally believe that in order for social media to work, it has to be an integration of multiple channels.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have Twitter. We're also on Facebook. We're also on Instagram. So we've got, and we have a blog and a website. So we have the digital component mm-hmm. covered. But to take this offline, it is a little bit unique. But then what we'll do is we'll bring it back online. So we'll have the event offline. People can actually meet each other, which is extremely powerful, as we all see right now in this show. Looking at you eyeball to eyeball
yeah.
is different than if we were recording from our phones. And then what we'll do is we'll take that experience and we'll bring it back into social. So we will live stream what the chefs are cooking. We'll tweet. We'll do bunches of Instagram photos. So again, we'll marry both of them.
And then you can take that content and repurpose it for months, weeks, months, right?
You've got it.
So then it's, you do it once, but then you can use it for a long period of time.
Absolutely.
So, and that's where an ROI would come in, for a bang for your buck, in terms of just the content marketing part of this.
Right.
I love it. I would think that once a restaurant group and or chef understood what you were doing, how you were doing it, and why you were doing it, I would think they would jump all over this. If you could have this level of conversation, or maybe you can just show them, hey, look what we've been doing.
Yeah. Yeah. We're hoping. We've talked to many of our chefs, and they're on board, and they're coming back to us saying, we love the idea, just let us know when, and we'll make sure we fit it into our schedule. And so we're extremely excited about working with the Atlanta Art Institute. I think that adds another degree of credibility, and also it brings the students in. And
yeah.
so here we are, we're giving a little bit back to the students. And of course, there'll be some sort of a charity component where we give back to the community at large.
Right. And then you add a kids component, you've got all your bases covered.
I love it.
So now for you, when you're doing this, how important is the Atlanta food scene in this?
It's important because...
But this is a global network though, right? Or at least national?
Well, Diva Foodies... digitally, obviously, is global, because as soon as you step into the digital
right.
world, you're global. But because this is a real life, so to speak, in real life event, the real life community, the food community, the people who really love to eat, who love gourmet food, who love chefs and food TV, it's very important for us to build those relationships here.
Here, locally. Well, Atlanta is a great foodie town, I believe.
Yeah, I do
yeah.
too. But it can and may very well be replicated in other markets at some point, yeah?
Shh, don't tell anybody, but that's our next big dream.
Like San Francisco, right?
Yes.
That's right.
We might know somebody there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we want to create the model here and then take it national.
So now, so the next thing, what do you have going on next?
Developing sponsorships for this program.
That's the most important thing right now on your plate, is just to get more sponsors involved. And then what does a sponsor look like for you? Is it like the school? Or is that a typical sponsor, or you're going for more?
We're going for monetary. The school will be in kind, and actually we will probably pay the school back for their services and for what they're doing for us. They'll probably buy the food because of the credibility factor and the liability. So anybody that we're looking for corporate sponsors, monetary corporate sponsors, because we can't put this on without it.
Right. And so you're kind of taking a page out of like the... like kind of PBS-y, where it's like an underwriter type situation, not like an ad and interruption kind of.
Yes. That's
not NASCAR-y, but more elegant than that.
Not that there's anything wrong with NASCAR, no. Just but, to be clear.
I mean, I don't know. I'm asking, is that your vision of this?
Well, what we'll do is we'll make sure that I think it's a mashup.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a mashup, Lee. We will obviously promote them through multiple channels and a little booklet at the event. We see a little vendor alley so that they can
show their wares,
talk to the guests.
But do you see it as the sponsor being a food brand?
Not necessarily.
But it could be like Sysco, where it's a food distributor, or it could be a maker of food, like a, you know, knives or something.
Right. Or it could be Whole Foods, or it could be a Kroger, or it even could be the Lexus dealer down the street. Because remember, who they are actually selling to are the chefs to some extent, but not really, but it's the guests that are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And the guests that are coming in, we assume are going to be in a higher income bracket. They like food. They like to travel. They probably buy a high-end car.
So that's how you're building your sponsor package. So somebody who is trying to reach these hard to reach, higher end, more affluent foodie type fans, that's a good sponsor for you.
Yes.
Well, it goes back to what you said earlier in the conversation, creating this win-win-win environment. You are developing the ecosystem, and then you're nurturing it with all of these mechanisms. And I'm absolutely fascinated with this Twitter thing. There's got to be a way to incorporate that into some of what we do.
Sure.
I don't know what it is, but Ryan, between you and Toby, you'll get it figured out.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, we'll talk after. Yes.
I got your contact
information. As far as monetization, I think I would feel like I had a really healthy ROI if I just got some food out of it.
Okay, there you go.
You work for food. So for you, Foodie Divas, that's part of your portfolio in Bloomberg Marketing, right?
Yes.
So you have other diva...
Yeah, I love it. I've got other diva stuff going on here. So the Diva Foodies concentrate specifically on the culinary world.
Right.
Bloomberg Marketing / Diva Marketing concentrates on everything else. So we have other clients, and not very many in technology, but a few. Some nonprofits we've worked with, B2B, B2C.
But it's the same strategy of going into a vertical like food and then building out multiple channels.
Right. Yeah. And we like to integrate, again, offline with online. And my background also includes some marketing research. So we take a very traditional approach. So we bring a lot to the table, a little bit more, I think, than most digital consultants might bring.
Good stuff. So if somebody wants to learn more about Diva Foodies, the website?
DivaFoodies.com. And our handle is @DivaFoodies on Twitter, on Instagram. And on Facebook, it is facebook.com/DivaFoodies. And if you want to email us, it's foodies@DivaFoodies. We're totally branded, Diva Foodies.
And then this hashtag food TV chat, that you can go to the website and you'll see the schedule for the next one.
Yes. And also you can go to the website and you'll see what we also do is we take, you mentioned that reusing content.
Right.
We go back in and we look at the interview. And we pull the tweets and the questions, and we make a post out of it. So it comes into a Twitter interview that we can post on our website. So
good stuff. So divafoodies.com is where you can go for all that information. And then if they had a question and maybe they're not in the food, but they're in a different market that wants to leverage this, the way that you're leveraging technology and digital and traditional and in real life, the website for that? Diva Marketing.
DivaMarketingBlog.com. And the email is Toby@BloombergMarketing.com.
All right. Toby, how about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
I would love to.
Okay, next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us President with Lina Group, Miss Teresa Lina Stevens. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what did you learn in that last segment?
Well, it was absolutely fascinating. And Diva Foodies is a perfect example of the types of companies that, or I should say, of the type of strategy we try to get companies to pursue in the market. So what a great lead in.
It's almost like we planned this just for
you. I know.
We're glad to be your friend person.
Thank you, Toby.
So, Teresa, can you share what you're up to?
Sure. Well, first, I'm based in the San Francisco Bay Area, although I lived in Atlanta for a long time. I work in the San Francisco area in Silicon Valley. We have a strategic marketing consulting firm focused on market dominance strategy for technology companies, mm-hmm. primarily. And what brings me to town is that I'm giving a pitching workshop tomorrow at the Atlanta Technology Village, which is open to anybody. So if you'd like to come, please do.
What time?
It's from 2 to 3:30 p.m.
And then, so who should attend this?
You know, it's really geared toward anybody who needs to make persuasive presentations, but it's particularly geared toward entrepreneurs, business owners, or people in sales and marketing who find themselves constantly needing to pitch their story or their company.
So you have a unique pitching strategy?
I do, yes.
You're going to share some of the secret sauce here?
Sure, sure. Well, first, you know, as you know, I'm sure you hear pitches all day long. You probably realize too, or would agree that many pitches pretty much stink.
I was going to say, are sometimes wanting. But yes, you're right. Some of them stink.
So I'm curious, from your viewpoint, since you do hear pitches all day long, what would you say is wrong with a lot of pitches that you hear?
I think a lot of times they're, I call it too internal. Like it's all about them. It's not about how they're helping me.
Serving, yeah.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the problem with most pitches is people don't draw the audience in. They don't make the audience want to hear what they have to say. And so the key is finding a way to hook people and reel them in. And so while most pitching workshops and a lot of content out there that teaches people about pitching, a lot of it's just generic presentation, skill building, and often focuses even on just the slides or the structure, the contents of what your pitch should contain. But what my workshop really focuses on is how to structure your message and how to do it in a way that draws the audience in and makes them want to keep hearing what you have to say. So it's the primary emphasis is a three-part pitch structure that talks about first, you want to talk about why there's a problem. So it's not just that there's a problem, but why it's a problem. Then you talk about what needs to be done about it. So most people will start with their solution, and then they might back into what the problem is. Frequently, by the time they're done, you don't even know really what they do. And if you understand a little bit of what they're doing, a lot of times you're not clear, well, why would anybody need that? So this way, you start by talking about the problem and what's of interest to the audience, exact opposite of what you just said, Lee. Mm-hmm. And then you offer a prescription independent of yourself. So they still want to hear, you know, the advice. You're giving advice on what companies need to be doing or what individuals need to be doing to solve the problem. And this is actually also your opportunity to preempt objections so that you can say, now you might be thinking such and such, or now many companies will do such and such. So you can preempt objections that way so that by the time you're going to start talking about your solution, they're actually dying to hear it. You've set it up in a way that makes it almost sound like an insurmountable problem. And then you've offered a solution, but that sounds, you know, the next question people often want to know is, well, how do I do that? And then you introduce, well, what we've created is such and such that does such and such. And then you can introduce your secret sauce as part of that.
So then your company becomes kind of the payoff.
That's right.
And then you spend two thirds of the time just kind of defining the problem. You're kind of using the like a storytelling structure,
narrative structure. Exactly. It's exactly right. So you have the problem, you set up the problem in conflict
and create conflict.
Then you have a build.
Right.
And then
it
you
seems
have
like the, you're never going to make it.
That's
and then
right.
The hero,
exactly.
And then your company is the hero that saves the day.
In fact, in the workshop, I talk about how movies are a little bit of an example of the ingredients you need. So you need great story. You need phenomenal performance. And so we, in the workshop, we talk a little bit about performance components that enhance your storytelling and your pitch.
Right.
And then also props. So for example,
So you actually use props.
Well, yes, there are lots of props. If you think about it, first of all, a lot of people start with their slides, which is a big mistake. Your slides are not the presentation. A lot of people make the mistake of filling their slides with all kinds of detail and just, you know, noise. So the
And that's distracting.
Totally distracting. Of course, people are going to read what's on the slide before they'll listen to what you're saying. I mean, that's just well-documented research-based conclusion right there. So the key is develop your story first. I use post-it notes. In the workshop, we use post-it notes. We start with three sentences to your entire presentation. And
that right there, you're causing conflict for the person, right? They're like, there's no way. My thing is way more.
I can't boil it down.
It's impossible. Just you don't know what my idea is. I've spent a lot, years working
That's
on
right.
this idea. There's no way I'm going to fit this in three
it's
sentences.
It's profound.
Exactly. So how do you move them past that?
Well, this pitch structure, we start just with three sentences, the why, the what, and the how. And the slides come last. The slides are simply support for what you're doing. And
should the slides be less words and more just images that are
exactly
powerful
right.
that you create? Because ultimately, you want to create some emotional connection, not an intellectual connection.
That's the whole key to this, is engaging the audience emotionally. So that's why you need a story with a buildup, a conflict, a buildup, a resolution, the payoff. You need great presentation or performance. And then you also need your props to make it engaging. So one of the analogies I use in the workshop is the Wizard of Oz. You have this great story with constant little, every time you think they're out of trouble, they're back in trouble.
Right. There's
right?
different trouble. Right.
So it's constantly going on. They start off with a bang with a tornado.
Right.
You have tremendous performance with all the characters,
right.
all
memorable
the actors.
Characters,
yeah.
Right.
I will always associate Judy Garland with the Wizard of Oz.
Sure.
And then you have the tremendous props. I mean, the iconic ruby slippers.
Right.
If somebody says the words ruby slippers, you immediately
or
think of the Wizard
monkeys.
Of Oz. Flying monkeys, right. which I wouldn't let my daughters watch the movie until they were older because of those darn
That's
flying
scary.
Monkeys. And then, you have the witch's feet sticking out from under the house. You have the yellow brick road. Props include music. You have the iconic song from, Over the Rainbow.
Right.
So with a presentation, powerful presentations do include props, demonstrations. There's nothing more powerful than pulling out the actual product and showing it in use if it's something that lends itself to that. So all of these are components of a compelling story, and that's really what you're after with a pitch, not just, vomiting data about
all
your product,
benefits.
All your R&D, the market potential, blah, blah, blah. Right. Even with an investor presentation, the main emphasis needs to go on how you tell your story of what you do and why it's important. And then, with each piece of it, you're reeling the investors in with wanting to know more and more and more, to the point where then they start asking you questions about, well, what's the market potential? What's it going to take how much is it going to take to develop this?
Right.
How much money am I going to make back on this? If they're not asking about your product and offering first, rest doesn't matter. So the whole goal is to reel people in. In the workshop, I talk about pitching is just a terrible metaphor because you're throwing stuff at somebody, which is how most people approach their pitches, right? So fishing is a better metaphor. You want to bait them, hook them, and reel them in. Slowly reel them in. Each piece of the presentation is reeling them in further and further. So that's the real objective.
That's I have a degree in advertising. This is what we learned in advertising. It's you don't want to be the company that says, I'm great. You want to do the thing that your customer says, they're great.
Exactly. I mean, it's got to be all about them. They want to know, any audience wants to know, what's in it for me? What's this going to do for me?
But the best payoff is one where the audience self-discovers your solution, not you knocking them over the head with the solution that you're kind of forcing them to know about.
Right, right. By the end, they're saying, please let me buy. How does it work?
I want to know. Now, for you, I would love to see you in action convincing all these engineer mindsets that are very fact-based and linear thinking. Hey, you know what? All those facts, let's just pause them over here. Let's get to the why and the emotion behind your solution. How do you make that kind of mental shift for these people?
Well, you know, the good news about doing this in a workshop format is you can engage people, get them involved in the process. So I don't stand up and give an hour-long presentation. We, you know, every 10 minutes, they're working on their pitches. And so we're going through it step by step. And so they get to actually see the contrast between what they started with and what they end up with.
You kind of make them have homework where they come in with their current pitch, like a baseline of this is what it looks like today. And then
they
an hour, they're going to look like.
I mean, ideally, in a, this is only going to be a 1.5 hour workshop, but in a longer form, I do this also as a half day. I mean, we can spend a day or even a week. We can go into as much depth as people want. But in a half day format, we can videotape their before so that at the end of the day, they can look at their after. But I do an example of that in the workshop. So I took a pitch off of it was a YouTube-based pitching show.
Oh, so it had nothing to do with you.
I took some random guy's pitch. And, you know, I show that at the beginning of the workshop.
Right.
And then I go through the techniques. And then at the end, I have my voiceover redoing his pitch.
Oh, wow.
With the same exact...
With the same tape, same amount of time.
Except as you're,
but I give the pitch the way I think it should be done. Yeah. And I did contact him.
Oh, by the way.
I said, please don't take this the wrong way.
But I've shown this to thousands of people.
I had to get his permission because I have a version of this workshop up online on I work with Stanford University also with in the entrepreneurship area of the engineering school. And I did an online pitching module for one of their online training sites that anybody can access.
When they did the MOOC where it was...
It's like a mini MOOC.
Uh-huh.
We called them JOLTS, just-in-time online training.
I like it.
Better branding than a MOOC.
That's right.
That's a terrible name.
So I have the training up online and I wanted to offer some examples. So I found this guy, his pitch, and I contacted him and asked him, I'm sorry, you know, it's possible that thousands of people around the world are going to see this, but do you mind if
that's the good news?
Redo
the context might be the bad news.
Good visibility. If you're into all PR is good PR, this will be great for you.
So I got to know, what's your backstory? You're recovering from some stint with the Big Four, the Big Eight, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So tell us your backstory and how it kind of led to doing this.
Sure. I started my career with Accenture here in Atlanta. Actually, I have a lot of former colleagues all over the city who I just adore. We had a very close relationship, all of us in the Atlanta office. And I then got into a global role leading marketing for the communications industry group. So it was worldwide director of marketing for that. And then I went off on my own to start doing strategic marketing consulting and started a firm. And as I was working with companies, I just found myself getting, and this was primarily technology services at the time. So, very intangible, that no product you could touch or feel. And I found myself getting so frustrated trying to convince them that they did not sound any different from anybody else. they sounded just, you know, oh, we have the best people.
Right.
We have the best methodology. We have the best client list. Well, who doesn't? You know, right. Who's saying, oh, we have terrible people?
Yeah, I love when they take really taglines and then they say, identify the company. And
that's
they're
right.
Like, you can't tell one from another.
Exactly. So I was getting so frustrated not having a way to convince them they didn't sound different. And then I didn't really have a formula for how to then make them sound different,
right?
And to differentiate them and help them clarify that, or I guess get that differentiation across in the marketplace. So I developed a methodology, a market dominance methodology, with the goal of helping companies establish themselves as the go-to. When you're a me too, which most companies are, they look and sound like everybody else. Of course, as you know, the problem becomes you have to start competing on price. You have no other reason for anybody to buy you versus the competition. And eventually your margins start shrinking and over time you go out of business. I mean, there's no way to survive. Expenses only go up unless you're in the kind of business that can squeeze down cost, but even that has a limit. So your real goal as a business, people get so focused on revenues, and I know investors very much focus on revenues, but particularly for private companies, my approach is that first you focus on increasing your margins so that you have plenty of ramp for growing your business. If your margins are high, you have lots of money to invest.
And screw up.
That's right.
Because that's built into this.
Absolutely.
Right?
There's a ton of experimentation that goes on. Nobody has a crystal ball. So focus on differentiating yourself clearly, having a clear, compelling reason for people to seek you out. Eventually, you become the go-to in your market, and you get to a point where you're not competing against everybody and anybody. People are starting to seek you out. I think Toby's a great example of that with Diva Foodies. And eventually, you get to, you know, you're the leader in the market. You're the center of the ecosystem. Everybody associates you with the solution. Examples of this might be Salesforce, which entered a very competitive full market, but differentiated itself by being a service, not embedded software, installed software. I mean, there are lots of examples out there, but that was my passion.
The blue ocean, kind of where you're trying to create your own niche.
Metaphor I use is the moonshot, which you hear often. Mm-hmm. So I actually call the methodology the Apollo method for market dominance, because the Apollo space program is an interesting model for doing this, where the U.S. was getting, I guess I can be a little more casual on the radio, it's butt kicked by the Soviets in space. The Soviets kept one-upping us.
Right.
We were going at it incrementally. So we would put a satellite in there. They'd send a dog out in space or what have you. So finally, Kennedy said, by golly, we're going to make a giant leap. We're going to put a man on the moon and bring him home. And then all the resources of NASA and multiple space agencies got consolidated. All the energy started getting poured into one major giant mission. And it became very clear as to what the United States space program stood for. And they rallied people around it. So the Apollo method for market dominance has a 4-stage. I won't go into that now, maybe another time when we have more time, if you want. But it's a 4-stage process. And companies need to do all 4 stages in order to achieve not just initial differentiation, but sustainable differentiation in a way that builds their reputation over time. And it's not just a matter of building reputation based on image and PR and so forth, but it's also on execution and actually making it happen with customers.
And really creating that big why, though.
That's right.
That mission-oriented thing that people can get behind.
Right. You own a problem in the marketplace, and you become associated with that problem, and you have a unique solution for solving that problem, and you have a strong point of view about why companies need to take this approach. And that's a much more compelling story than just we have some widget or some piece of software that helps you do such and such and such. You know, you quickly become a me too. Software is really susceptible because it takes nothing, especially nowadays, for people to match you on functions and features.
Right.
So people with apps and software and websites and so forth, you know, I know the media faces this challenge. You guys are an example of great focus. But there are lots of companies out there that just try to be all things to all people.
Right.
And they don't mean anything.
You got
to
pick a lane.
But it's an easy trap to fall into. I mean, it is.
Right.
Well, it's a little counterintuitive because it feels very dangerous to focus.
Because you're putting all your eggs in one basket.
That's right. You feel like you're limiting your opportunities. But the fact is, if you pick the right market, you want to pick, it doesn't, just because it's narrow doesn't need to mean it needs to be small. And it only
or
needs...
Or shallow. It could
that's
be
right.
Deep.
That's exactly right. And it also only needs to be huge in relation to you.
And what your objective is.
That's right. Because a little drop of ink in a vast ocean isn't going to show up, right? But you put a little drop of ink in a shot glass, and then that gets darker. And then you put it into a coffee cup and then a bowl, and then you can go from there. So
now, does this strategy work for companies like an accounting firm or like kind of these commodity type services where, you know, there's lots of people doing a similar function?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you can see even with Toby as an example, the talking about the diva foodies, you know, she was so interesting talking about what she's focused on. And clearly she's establishing herself as the center of a little ecosystem, right? Now it would be way harder to do that in the generic social media market.
Like so if she says, I'm a social media expert.
Right. So, yeah, I do social media. Well, okay. How interesting for you.
Right. And so,
so do a million other people.
Right. But by owning this brand and this, this kind of ecosystem, then she's the queen of that ecosystem. And then, of course, she would do other ones. Like, it makes, you know.
Right. So, you know, she has a point of view about what companies, about what chefs and the food world needs to be doing in terms of social media and building their brands. And she has an approach for doing that. And she's creating a community of believers around her.
Right.
All right, before we wrap, let's make sure that our listeners know about this workshop, maybe upcoming workshops, and a good way to get in contact and have a conversation with you or someone on your team. What's the best
way? Sure. So the workshop, again, is at the Atlanta Technology Village. It's at from 2 to 3:30 p.m. It's on Eventbrite, but you can also get it on their, you can also get information about it on their website, atlantatechvillage.com. And if you go to events, it's listed on there, and there's a link to the registration page on Eventbrite. You might be able to get to it by searching Eventbrite. I'm not sure.
Now, is this a fee to attend this? Or
no,
this,
it's free.
This a free
so
workshop.
Take advantage of it, because it's usually
more than free.
More than free. Yes. Yes. A lot of good. And we are going to be, and if you don't have a pitch to work on, that's okay, because we can work in groups and you can help other people. And sometimes that's even more powerful because you're not all caught up in your own thinking around your own story. So it helps you really reinforce the concepts. And then my website is www.linagroup.com, as in Carolina, L-I-N-A group.com.
Well, this has been so much fun and very informative for me. I am so glad that you had the time and energy to spend with us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been a blast.
How about hanging out with us? We got one more guest we're going to visit with.
I'd love to.
All right. You ready for the headliner, Lee?
All right.
She's been sitting there very patiently, but taking a lot of notes. I saw her head nod quite a bit, and I might have sensed that her mouth was watering in the first segment when we were talking about food. Please join me in welcoming back to the Business Radio X microphone, District Director with the U.S. Small Business Administration, Miss Terry Dennison. How you doing, sunshine?
I'm doing great.
It is so good to see you again. How's your behavior been since I saw you last?
Oh, I've been a good girl.
So what's happening at the SBA?
Well, we finished up, of course, at the end of September, our fiscal year 16. And we had a press release out with our results in terms of our lending.
So how'd you do?
We actually did very well. We had a record year, $1.4 billion, basically, in SBA-backed lending. which is a record. In fact, for the past, out of the past 5 years, the last three of those years
have been
1 billion or more.
Wow.
So that's always reassuring in terms of, okay, we're getting farther and farther beyond the Great Recession.
So now, what is the profile of a person getting one of those loans? What do they look like?
Oh, wow. Well, in terms of, I guess, type of business, that's one way we can look at it. Our number one category is, interestingly enough, food and accommodation.
There you go. How about that?
So restaurants, both, you know, carry out full service, mm-hmm. as well as lodging. That's our number one. Services, both kind of general, non-professional services, and also scientific, technical,
technology,
administrative type services. We retail is in our top five.
What about the film? I heard the film industry is doing a lot. Are they getting loans from you guys, or they're getting funding elsewhere?
Well, we really don't have a category necessarily for films, but mm-hmm. there's so many different types of business activities that support
that.
Film.
Oh, yeah. So you're seeing that.
Like some, I would suspect some of the food and accommodations.
Oh, they might be catering for the movie sets and things
or
like
some
that.
Of the service related loans would probably come under that.
So with that kind of success in 2016, I'm thinking maybe you'll just shift gears and do something totally different in 2017. That's what we do in our business. You know, if it gets to working too good,
we like to pivot.
Well, I guess the thing, you know. At a national level, what the agency is trying to do is, of course, try to make the process simpler for the lender. Because, of course, what we do primarily is guarantee loans made by commercial lenders.
Right.
So working with our lending community to make that process easier. And that subsequently make it easier. Yes.
That would be good.
Those are always our focus. So we'll continue that in 2017.
Now, can you share a little bit for the person who's out there and maybe they have their own business, maybe they're working for a firm and they're on the side, they have a side thing going, which I'm sure you see quite a bit, and they're about to make the plunge and they're thinking about getting lending. Can you walk us through what that process, what are some of the things that a person would have to do to get?
Well, actually, I would back them up before we even get to money to make sure that the idea that they have is solid. Because one of the number one mistakes people do is they take the first idea and run with it. They put whatever resources they have at hand into that first idea. And then they get to the end of their resources and they don't really have anything to show for it. So I would advise them to visit some of our resource partners, mm-hmm. such as the Small Business Development Centers or SCORE, our volunteer partner mm-hmm. organization, or our Women Business Centers. And kind of lay out, this is what I've been thinking.
Right.
And kind of vet that idea and maybe do some market research to make sure that there's a need for it.
And then so once they have and they go, okay, that's a winner. Okay. So now they go to the bank. Is that the first step?
Yes. They would go to the lender and submit an application.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, because they've gone to our technical resource partner, they have a good idea of how much they need and what they need it for.
Right.
They would go ahead and submit an application. The lender would determine whether they need to make loan conventionally, which in case we are not involved, or the only way we can make this loan is if the SBA guarantees it. And that's when the lender comes to us.
So that's where your guys get involved. Now, what are some of the criteria? Like, what is the size of a loan typically? Is it like $1,000 or is it like $1 million? Okay.
Well, in terms of our two main loan programs, I would say that the maximum loan amount that we will guarantee is $5 million.
Wow.
Okay. Technically, there isn't a minimum, but commercial lenders, you know, they only are going to make loans over a certain amount just because the economics.
That would get us through Christmas, don't you think? $5 million?
I think so.
Yeah.
We can even give Ryan a bonus.
We also have, for those who maybe need a little less money, you know, $10,000, $20,000. We have a microloan program mm-hmm. that is delivered through approved nonprofit organizations.
So now how does that program work? What's an approved nonprofit organization?
Well, they're an entity that do microloans. They make mm-hmm. small loans. They also provide technical assistance pre-loan, during the lending process, and post-loan. The focus is on the smaller loan amounts.
And that you said that's under $50,000 or under?
Yes.
And so that requires less paperwork, less documentation, or it's still the same process?
It pr- probably they'll ask for a lot of the same things in terms of, you know, projections, business plan, if it's a new business, what are you going to bring to the table in terms of equity injection? You should have some skin in the game.
Right.
All right, let's walk this thing through. I have just a marvelous lasagna recipe. I think I'm going to, you know, the radio business has been fun, but I'm going to open a restaurant. So I need to get some guidance, right? So I might come to you and at first blush, I just think, look, all I need is $1.5 million. I got this cutest little place over in Marietta Square. And the first thing you're going to say, well, that's fantastic, Stone, but let's get you hooked up with these folks over at SCORE or one of these resources, right? Can you just kind of walk us through what that might look like from a, you know, a wide-eyed, aspirational entrepreneur? Walk us through some of the big steps of that. Could you do that? Because I think there's a lot of folks out there that don't, that this process of going and capitalizing on the SBA resources is just a big, hairy thing. So can you, let's just walk through it.
Okay, so you decide, okay, I've got this idea for the restaurant. Let's say you'll go to SCORE to and set up an appointment with one of our counselors. They will, you'll share with them your idea. If you have any financials.
And then how much is this? Like, how much is this fee to get started?
The best price there is, free.
So
yeah, I don't think a lot of people know this. And I mean, these are seasoned people that know
that
business
been there,
that are
done
right
that.
There right. at your fingertips.
And many of them have actually operated restaurants. So they'll ask you a lot of questions and really play devil's advocate.
And they're going to challenge you, and they're going to ask you hard questions. This isn't like just great job, you should do this.
Right.
They're trying to poke holes in this because they want to make sure that this is an idea that has a shot.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm going to throw some Teresa sauce on them though now that I know
I'm
that.
I'm
going to
dominate.
I'm going to go to that workshop.
I'm going to dominate.
Yeah, they're going
to. That's the word of the day.
And they may even suggest that since you may, it sounds like you're, since you're here, I'm assuming you're not running a restaurant already. So you might need some experience in that industry. So maybe attend some of their training classes. They might even recommend that you maybe work as a manager or do something in the food industry before you actually
Go work in a restaurant for a week and then come back and tell me you want to be
a
restaurant.
Still want to do it.
Exactly.
That'll weed out like 80%.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so you go through that process, come up with projections. There's training on how to do that.
Training on how to forecast, how to come up with these.
Okay. Our Small Business Development Center is also doing an excellent job of that process. So you can come up with viable, reasonable numbers, realistic numbers.
Right.
And then kind of put together the business plan. You can work, you know, there's training to do that. And they'll also coach you through that process as you draft something.
And this training, there's fees with that, or that also is?
Sometimes training, there is a cost. The SBA allows them to cover the cost of the training, but they cannot make a profit off of it. So reasonably priced.
So you're not going to
training.
Be paying corporate training. But I'll tell you what I'm beginning to realize here. Even if I wanted to do that and Uncle Louie left me $1.5 million, if I'm smart, I go through this process whether I need to go borrow money or not, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, it's funny, sometimes people think, now if you're starting off, obviously you're going to need money, but a lot of times existing businesses, like we need to get a loan to expand or whatever, and then you look at their cash flow or you look at their balance sheet and you're like, well, you've got money here. You've got receivables that have been hanging out there for 4 months.
Right. You know, so if you fix that, you don't
need
the loan.
You need to be more efficient with what you have.
Right. So just going through that process can help educate you.
Well, look at the level of education that you're getting here for an incredibly modest to almost $0.
Well, you in a sense, you have paid for it. You're a taxpayer.
Right.
Your tax dollars are covering this.
Now, what are some other SBA resources maybe that people don't realize that are available to them?
Oh, wow. Of course, we have our website, SBA.gov. We have online training that's available on that site. Over 50 training modules on a variety of subjects having to do with starting and operating a business. We actually also have access to a software called Sizeit, which allows the person to do some basic market research based on their type of business and where they're located. They can see where possible suppliers are in their location, possible competitors. So that can help them begin the process of market research.
Incidentally, if there's no competitors, it may not be a fantastic idea, right? Don't let that dissuade you just because you get out there and see some potential. No, that's something that startup-y folks need to realize.
And that's why it's good to work with someone to vet the idea. Is there is it really a wide open market, or is the issue there's not a market.
Right.
There's a difference.
And then there's also Lindsay Williams photography at SBA, right? Or is that just on these interviews?
Yes.
So now, for the person that wants to learn more, what's the best first step for them?
I would suggest that they go to our website, sba.gov, and they can put in the shortcut GA for Georgia. Mm-hmm. That'll take them directly to the Georgia District Office website so they can see specifically what resources and activities we have going on.
And then on a regular basis, you're having workshops. There's yes. free stuff happening probably almost weekly, right?
Yeah. And we have some at our office, but our resource partners conduct the vast majority of the SBA
spread throughout
training.
The state.
Exactly.
So it could be in a neighborhood near you, there is some training probably occurring yes. sometime yes. during the course of the year.
Yes, we also do webinars. Mm-hmm. So if you're not here in Atlanta, you can access training that way as well.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago online modules, mm-hmm. and that's something that anybody can tap into?
Yes, anybody.
And what's an example of some of the kind of content you might find on there?
Well, you know, how to put together a business plan, how to do market research, mm-hmm. Strategic planning. You know, once you've been in business, what do you do to position yourself to continue growing the business? I think we have a unit... a module now on cybersecurity. Because that's
oh,
yeah.
oh, that makes sure. a lot of right. sense. Maybe a link to Teresa's YouTube where she voiceovers that pitch guy, right?
At a pitch.
Now, no, that's fantastic, yeah. though. I don't think the
most people are aware realize, of all the resources.
Yeah.
How to put together a loan proposal.
Now, can you share, before we wrap, your most proudest story that you've helped somebody? You know, had a dream and then maybe help them make it real.
Oh, wow. There's quite a few of those.
Maybe one that touched your heart in this holiday season.
Well, the one, I guess, as we're thinking of the holidays, the one that comes to mind is Elf on the Shelf.
Mm-hmm.
They worked with our Small Business Development Center in Kennesaw.
Really?
Back in the day. And,
because they're everywhere
they've grown,
now.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and with that
right?
resource, they've actually grown the business to where they now export this
all
to,
over the country,
all the world. Yes.
Wow. And it started out of going through one of these workshops. So you never know.
Yeah.
That's an amazing story.
That is the story for this. That's fantastic.
What, you were going to say something?
Oh, just that my daughter's going to be so excited when I tell her this.
Small world, right? So go full circle for you. All right. So the website again.
www.sba.gov/GA.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
My pleasure.
This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton and all of the Business Radio X family. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.